Reading this morning from Genesis chapter 26. And there was a famine in the land beside the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went unto Abimelech, king of the Philistines, unto Gerar. This chapter of Genesis is the only one that is primarily devoted to the life of Isaac. It's an interesting character because in addition to being a type of Christ, which we see in the episode of Abraham sacrificing Isaac, I think he's also a type of the church, which is the body of Christ, of course, so that would make sense. But not a whole lot of space is given, really, to the particulars of Isaac's life. But he actually lived the longest of the three patriarchs, nonetheless. And it would almost appear that Isaac, one of the things that we sort of learn from Isaac is that our lives are not about ourselves, and the church is not about its own existence or its own promotion. Very few people think very much about Isaac at all, because he's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know, just kind of in between there. And that's not a bad thing. You know, we might think of it as, well, poor Isaac, he doesn't get to have all of the great revelations of Abraham, be called the father of faith. And of course, everybody identifies with Jacob because he was such a rascal and he had so many hairy episodes. You know, just a more interesting story. Isaac is just kind of a long 180 years with not a whole lot happening. Isaac carried on the legacy of Abraham. And, you know, the expression, there's no news is good news, could apply here. What Isaac didn't do, once again, is very significant in the story of his life. We see him, what he didn't do in the story of when he was sacrificed by Abraham. He did not resist. He did not question. He allowed this in his life. But we see that, too, that God does not allow him to exclusively skate by on the faith of Abraham. We see that there was another famine in the land beside the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. So you cannot just rely on your spiritual ancestors and say, well, I know my mother, my grandfather, my whoever it was, the spiritual influence in my life passed through X, Y, and Z, and there was a great spiritual victory won there, so I'll just coast for the rest of my life. That's not gonna work. You know, God has no grandchildren, and every one of us has to pass through things before God to test our own faith. And this is what was happening to Isaac, presumably, as this famine came along, and, you know, all of a sudden he's a stranger in the land, he's not established, kind of a apparently nomadic herdsman. A famine could wipe out a family. This almost happened to Jacob's family later on during the famine in which they wound up going down to Egypt and Joseph taking care of them. So this was a serious matter. And Isaac goes to the Philistines. So the land of the Philistines is roughly between the land that would later become the land of Israel and Egypt. So he was sort of maybe inclined to head that way a little, angling that way anyway. That was kind of where people tended to go when there was a famine or when there was any kind of trouble. Let's run to Egypt. Much the way we think of run to the world. Egypt was the dominant civilization at the time. It's where everything was happening. It had been going for hundreds of years. They had the pyramids. They had all the advancement. It was kind of the capital of the world. It's like the America of its day. And so it was a place that you would feel a lot more comfortable being in a time of difficulty. God did allow Abraham to go down there. The results were not very good, however, because he walked in fear. And that was where he picked up Hagar, who was a basket of trouble later on. But God chooses this time to reveal himself directly to Isaac for the first time. In verse 2, "And the Lord appeared unto him and said, Go not down into Egypt. Dwell in the land which I shall tell thee of. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with thee, and will bless thee. For unto thee and unto thy seed I will give all these countries, and I will perform the oath which I swear unto Abraham thy father." It almost sounds like God is repeating himself when he says, "Dwell in the land which I shall tell thee of, sojourn in this land." And I don't know if this is if this is true or not, because I've checked other translations, and they all seem to agree that this is basically what God was saying, dwell in the land which I will tell you of. Which seems a little bit strange, because he was already in the land where that God had already promised. He said, Abraham, this is the land, you know, walk around it, and I'm going to give it to you. And then God himself, in the very next statement, says, sojourn in this land. There seems to be something more in view here, though. The word dwell, of course, is more carries a sense of permanency, or at least semi-permanency with it, whereas in the next sentence he says sojourn in this land. And I think perhaps this is tied to what the writer of Hebrews tells us that the patriarchs were really looking for. He said they were looking for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. That they understood in their spirits that their permanent dwelling place was not actually going to be found in this earth at all. That the promises that God made to give the physical land of Israel to the physical children of Abraham were not even the ultimate fulfillment. And the thing is, God's actual blessings are always more than we can possibly imagine them to be. The things that we come up with ourselves are nothing at all. The things that we think God is going to give us are even nothing compared to what God is actually going to do. And so God kept sort of putting it out there a little bit. Dwell in the land that I will tell you of. You have to keep on following by faith. It's not as though he handed the patriarchs a post-dated check. This is exactly how much you're going to get. You can cash it on this date. You have to keep following God by faith, not knowing precisely what it is he's going to do, perhaps, how he's going to do it, what's it going to look like, but knowing his character, knowing who he is, knowing that he wants to give us everything good, and therefore we can trust him. Verse 4, and I will make thy seed to multiply as the stars of heaven, and will give unto thy seed all these countries, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because that Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. I was thinking about how the Lord compares the offspring of Abraham, and we know we are. This is us. Paul says, if you are Christ's, then you are Abraham's seed, your heirs according to the promise. So this is talking about us. When the Lord promised that he was going to make Abraham's offspring as the stars. I was thinking about the stars, and the funny thing about the stars is, at this time when God spoke to Isaac, people didn't really know what they were. They had no concept of cosmology or astronomy. They knew they could look up on a dark night and see a lot of stars. And there actually were people in the ancient world who tried to count how many stars you could see with the naked eye, with varying degrees of success. But there was an attempt made to do it. And some people at that time might have said, ha ha, God said you couldn't count the stars, and I counted the stars. Well, then somebody invented the telescope. And guess what? The more we learn about the universe, the more incomprehensible it is. The closer you look at what appear to be stars, they actually turn out to be galaxies. And each one contains billions of stars, and it just boggles your mind more and more. And I was thinking about how the things that God does are the opposite of what man does. Man's work, the closer you look at it, the more you realize it really isn't all it's cracked up to be. You know, it has flaws, and it's already deteriorating before the paint's even dry on the car, it's starting to rust. I mean, it's always a letdown. It's always less than what you expect. God's work is always more than what you expect. And the more and the deeper you look into it, Darwin thought the cell was some kind of glob. Well, now they've discovered it's like a multi-industrial complex. I was reading yesterday somebody saying it's more complicated than a factory that produces Boeing jets. It's just incomprehensible how infinitely complex and perfectly ordered the work of God is. And Solomon actually says that God has done this so that no one can find it out, so that no one can find the work from beginning to end, so that we can see how great he is. And this should cause us, if we have a lick of sense, to see ourselves as the tiny, minuscule, infinitesimally small creation that we are, that we might fear him, and that we might appreciate his love for us and the promises that he has given us. And he says, this blessing is coming because Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. This is very interesting phrasing because, of course, the law of Moses had not been given. there are basically no laws specifically recorded that were given to Abraham. There was the covenant of circumcision, which was a symbol. But as far as God specifically commanding Abraham, don't eat pork, rest on the Sabbath, there wasn't any of that. It had not happened. But the first thing that God says that Abraham did is he obeyed my voice. And I was remembering that this particular phrasing is used later on. We'll get to it probably maybe next week. It's something that Rebecca says to Jacob, obey my voice. It's a parent-child relationship. You are naturally attuned to the voice of your parent, the one who has given birth to you, the one who's provided for you. And that's what God is to us. He's our Father. That's what was the natural relationship before the fall kind of messed things up. But the relationship that Abraham had, this kind of points forward. And because Paul points backward to it, saying Abraham had this righteousness, he was justified by faith because he believed God, because he had this parent-child, or rather as Abraham being the child to God being the parent, relationship with God, that he trusted him. And whatever God said, he did. He did not trust in his own moral reasoning, even to the point of being willing to kill his own son, if that was what God said to do. I was reading an interview the other day that Albert Mohler did with a secularist who actually made the statement, even if I knew that God had created the universe and created me, I would say no if he told me to kill my son. And I was just thinking how grossly, breathtakingly arrogant the human heart is. And this is my heart too, it's not just an atheist, that could even begin to imagine that we have the right or the ability to say no to God about anything. But this is why God said, when he saw Abraham's heart and being willing, he said, now I know that you fear God. You've got the right idea. That we obey God because of who he is. Because he is the creator. Because he is the Lord. Because although he has given us free will, in the exercise of it, we are completely subject to his will and desire. He can take away our breath at any moment. And he is entitled. For his pleasure, everything was and is created. We have no right to say anything to him about what he decides to give and take away. So Abraham had this relationship with God, and Isaac, even though he is being tested in his own relationship with the Lord, nonetheless is an inheritor of this promise, of this covenant that God had with Abraham. God specifically invokes Abraham here. And this is where I think Isaac, to some degree, typifies the church, because ours is an imputed righteousness. We are made children of God through Jesus Christ. We're made co-heirs. It's only because of the choices that Jesus made and of his sacrifice that we are rightly related to God the Father. That doesn't mean that we don't have to be sanctified, we do, and we have to have this work done in us that creates this relationship, but it's through Jesus. Everything goes through Jesus Christ, just as the covenant that came to Isaac came through Abraham. And Isaac dwelt in Gerar, and the men of the place asked him of his wife, and he said, she is my sister. For he feared to say, she is my wife, lest, said he, the men of the place should kill me for Rebekah, because she was fair to look upon. Obviously, history is repeating itself here. This is precisely the same thing that Abraham did in precisely the same place. Perhaps even with the same man, probably not. It's generally thought Abimelech was a title rather than a name in this case, because it would have been some 60 to probably 80 years, because Abraham's incident occurred shortly before the birth of Isaac, and this happens at a time when Isaac and Jacob are already old enough to be out on their own. I'm sorry, when Jacob and Esau old enough to be out on their own. So it's probably a different man. I don't know if he had not heard the story from his father or grandfather about what had occurred with Abraham before, that he was taken in by this. It was a worse thing for Isaac to do, really, because there was no grain of truth in it for Isaac. She was not really his sister. He was operating entirely out of fear and not out of faith at all. And the thing is, this is an example to us of how it is possible, just as the children of Israel saw God take them through the Red Sea and doubted, thought that he was going to kill them in the wilderness, Isaac had been through this incredibly dramatic experience of being offered on the altar, having the knife inches from his throat, and God intervening with an audible voice from heaven saying, do not harm him. So you would think he would have gotten the idea at this point, oh, okay, God is actually not wanting me to die. But this is what we are. We can go from an experience like that into this admittedly somewhat threatening situation, I suppose. You know, he's going in among the Philistines. And immediately think that we have to rely on ourselves for our protection. This is absolute nonsense, of course. Because if we realized that our breath was in God's hand, then we would also know that no one can do anything to us without his permission. So it is actually him, once again, that we discover we need to fear and we need to be in right relationship with. We do not need to go around trying to cover all the bases ourselves because we will fail. We will mess things up. Thankfully, God protected Isaac from messing things up any worse than he did, which wasn't all that bad. So it came to pass in verse 8, when he had been there a long time, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out at a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was sporting with Rebekah, his wife. And Abimelech called Isaac and said, behold, of a surety she is thy wife, and how saidst thou, she is my sister? And Isaac said unto him, because I said, lest I die for her. And Abimelech said, what is this that thou hast done unto us? One of the people might lightly have lain with thy wife, and thou shouldest have brought guiltiness upon us. And Abimelech charged all his people, saying, he that toucheth this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. This is a sad inversion. Because here we have the heathen king of the Philistines, who is actually showing more concern for Isaac's wife than Isaac himself. And this shows how much we can compromise God's testimony when we move in fear. When we have a fear of man, the heathen and the demons themselves tremble before God. And you can see that God put such fear in Abimelech. Maybe this did have something to do with the previous incident. I don't know. Such fear in Abimelech that when he found out that there was even the possibility that someone could have defiled Isaac's wife, he said, what have you done? You know, we could have really stepped in it here. And then issues this decree, anybody mess with these folks is a dead duck. So he actually was showing more fear of God in the situation and less fear of man than Isaac was. So this is bad, but this can very much happen when we take our eyes off the Lord. When we start thinking about, what is that person going to do? You know, if I don't do this, then this will happen. Instead of, and there's a sense in which here, I was reading one time, you know, that the Muslims who worship a false god, nonetheless, realize that they are not the ones in control. They believe that Allah is the one who wills all things. And the only reason that something happens is because he willed it. Which, that's not true of the god that they worship because it's a false god. But it actually is true of the true God. That all things are worked according to the counsel of his will. And if we would continually remind ourselves of this, we could take our eyes off men, including ourselves, and fix our eyes on the Lord, and we would not get into messes like this where the testimony ends up being compromised. But the Lord got it straightened out. And in verse 12 we find, then Isaac sowed in that land and received in the same year an hundredfold, and the Lord blessed him. And the man waxed great and went forward and grew until he became very great. For he had possession of flocks and possession of herds and great store of servants, and the Philistines envied him. This is actually the first use of the word envy in the Bible, which is kind of interesting. I think the Lord was able to bless Isaac in this situation because, actually kind of against his will, he had ended up walking in the truth. And you can also see this as kind of a situation where he was trying to be a little bit incognito and got found out. It's interesting that what the king of the Philistines saw him doing, which the King James translates sporting, nobody really knows exactly what to do with this because it actually means laughing. And it's the same root word as Isaac's own name comes from. So what precisely he was doing, kind of interaction they were having, we don't know. Obviously something that wouldn't be considered natural proper between a brother and sister, something that showed clearly she was his wife. But it is interesting to me that the word was the same root word as Isaac's name, because it kind of, I think, shows up the fact he wasn't being true to his identity, which was as a follower of a believer in the one true God. He was to have been a man of truth. And it had to be found out by someone else. And this we can actually see in the history of his descendants. Frequently the Jews have wanted to blend into societies. They've wanted not to be separate. Anything but that. Let's, you know, integrate ourselves. We'll make ourselves absolutely essential. And we'll make them like us. It never works, because they're God's chosen people. They are going to get chased out of every society where they try to integrate themselves. And this is exactly what happened. And God actually uses the sinful heart of man, and what is it work in the heathen, the spirit that works among the children of disobedience, to cause his children to be chased out of places where they don't belong. And I would say, although God permitted Isaac to remain in Gerar, it was not his will for him to be there long term. And so he allowed this envy to rise in the hearts of the Philistines toward Isaac for all the goods that God had bestowed on him. And God didn't have to give him all that. You know, he could have kept him, you know, just moderate so that it wouldn't excite any envy on the part of the Philistines. But God allowed this because he had a purpose in it. For all the wells which his father's servants had digged in the days of Abraham his father, the Philistines had stopped them and filled them with earth. Okay, this is really extreme. I was reading up on how much trouble it is to dig a well in Palestine. You actually have to dig through solid limestone in many cases, which is just a chip away at it for a long, long time. It's and I think you have to go fairly deep. You have to make it wide enough that people can actually, sometimes at least they would, where people actually walk down all the way to the bottom to draw water. Wells were very, very important in this part of the world at this time. People who controlled wells would often get wealthy by charging, no pun intended, by charging people to use them. And they became centers of commerce. You know, it was a big deal. The Philistines were so intent on removing, I can only imagine, the very memory of Abraham, that he had ever been there, that he had ever done anything. They were actually willing to take a very valuable resource and destroy it. And you can see this playing out over and over again, once again, with his descendants. People don't care that the Jews cause their societies to prosper, that they bring innovation, that they're smart, and they bring all kinds of economic prosperity along with it. They don't want it. If it's connected with God, if it says something, if it reminds us of him, it's because of that spirit that's working within them. It's self-destructive. They would rather destroy what is good than be reminded of God, and be reminded of his laws, and that they're in rebellion against him. So they would rather fill the wells with earth. And Abimelech said unto Isaac, "Go from us, for thou art much mightier than we." The first time the Jews had been kicked out, but not certainly the last. It's happened over and over and over again. But why are the Jews in Israel today? Why are they in the land where God promised they would be, in the place that he wants them? Because they were kicked out of everywhere else. And so you can't just assume that because these are bad things happening, that it's all bad. You know, you can look at the history of the Jews and go, man, that was horrible. Everything that happened to them, it was unfair, it was wrong, and it was. But that does not mean that God did not allow it and even order it for the good that he is working, because he intends for all Israel to be saved. And so he has regathered them from every nation on earth and actually caused them to be expelled from nations where they should have been integrated and welcomed, but they weren't. They were shut out. So in verse 17, "And Isaac departed thence and pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar and dwelt there. And Isaac digged again the wells of water which they had digged in the days of Abraham his father. For the Philistines had stopped them after the death of Abraham, and he called their names after the names by which his father had called them. And Isaac's servants digged in the valley and found there a well of springing water. And the herdmen of Gerar did strive with Isaac's herdmen, saying, 'The water is ours.' And he called the name of the well Esek, because they strove with him. And they digged another well and strove for that also, and he called the name of it Sitna." We start out with envy. Then we get to Isak, which is contention. Finally, we get to Sitna, which is hatred. That's the point at which jealousy has turned into contention, has turned into hatred, which is what caused Cain to kill Abel, his brother. We start out with, you've got something that's good, because it was a blessing from God, obviously. And the fact is, it is, as Mother used to say all the time, a level playing field. Anyone can obey God, keep his commandments, and inherit his blessings. But they didn't want to do that. They just wanted the blessings. And so they envied, and they strove, and finally they hated. And just like, just go away. We don't want you here. We don't want you close by. We don't want to see you. We don't want to think about you. We don't want you breathing our air. And so they keep pushing and pushing Isaac away. And once again, what in the story does Isaac not do? He doesn't fight back. And that's very significant, because he could have. It was clear that Abraham's servants knew how to fight when the situation required it. And they had indeed vanquished a huge army in time past. But there's no range wars going on here. Isaac just kept on relocating. He kept on moving back, just to find where the Lord wanted him to be. And he removed from thence and digged another well, and for that they strove not. And he called the name of it Rehoboth. And he said, for now the Lord hath made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land. I think it's very interesting that Isaac, once again, as I think typifying the church as the body of Christ, is primarily known for digging wells. And what do you do when you dig a well? You make a hole in the ground. For the most part, certainly somebody who didn't know what you're doing would think that is not very impressive. You know, where the people of the Tower of Babel wanted to build something, they reached all the way up to heaven. We'll get a name. We'll never be scattered. We'll be noticed. Even God will notice us. And the people of God are one bit at a time, making that hole deeper and deeper and deeper. And that's where the Lord wants his church to go, is deeper. And that's where the best water is down, way down. And the thing is, you don't have to pump it out of the ground. You don't have to go down there and squeeze the rocks with a giant hydraulic press. The water's there, you just got to get to it. And you have to create a space for it. You have to create capacity. And that's what digging a well is all about. It's about removing what was there so that you can get to what you want, which is down below. And I think that that's what the work that the Lord has his church doing. In some cases, quite literally, going into foreign countries and drilling wells for water. But spiritually, removing all that earth, everything that is of the earth, which is the self, which is the flesh, which is all of our thoughts and desires and ambitions and everything that goes along with life in this world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, digging it out and digging it out and digging it out until the water can flow and it can become a springing well. Actually, once you get down there, as we've discovered by accident, you end up with a spring you can't even necessarily control. It's just going to keep coming out. Actually, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob all dug wells. And it was Jacob's well on which Jesus sat and said to the woman from Samaria, whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. Whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will not thirst. But the water that I will give him will become in him a well of water springing up to everlasting life. And that's what the Lord wants us to be, is those wells of water that people will desire, that they might come and drink. Verse 23, and he went up from thence to Beersheba, and the Lord appeared unto him the same night and said, I am the God of Abraham thy father. Fear not, for I am with thee and will bless thee, and multiply thy seed for my servant Abraham's sake. And he builded an altar there, and called upon the name of the Lord, and pitched his tent there, and Isaac's servants digged a well. This is the second time the Lord has appeared to Isaac. And I can almost see him saying, it's like, he starts to head to Egypt, cold, no, That's not the right place. And as he keeps backing off, as the Philistines keep pushing him, and every time he gives up his rights, he surrenders what was his, he doesn't hold on to it, he doesn't fight, the Lord says, warmer, warmer, warmer. Okay, now you're hot. Now you're where I want you to be. Because you're surrendered. Because you're not trying to get something for self. You just are trying to be where I want you to be. And therefore you're there. Therefore we will be. We will find that place that is at the center of God's will if that's what we prioritize above everything else. But if we try to get things for self, then we'll end up down there with the rest of the world just scrapping for whatever piece of it we can get a hold of. Verse 26, then Abimelech went to him from Gerar, and Ahuzzath, one of his friends, and Phicol, the chief captain of his army. And Isaac said unto them, wherefore come you to me, seeing ye hate me, and have sent me away from you? And they said, we saw certainly that the Lord was with thee. And we said, let there now be an oath betwixt us, even betwixt us and thee, and let us make a covenant with thee, that thou wilt do us no hurt, as we have not touched thee, as we have done unto thee nothing but good, and have sent thee away in peace. Thou art now the blessed of the Lord. Well, this was a whopper. I really wonder how they had the chutzpah to come after him and say, we want to make a covenant because we've sent you away in peace and have done to you nothing but good, when they had, in fact, violently taken away at least two of the wells that his servants had doubtless devoted months or perhaps years in the digging of. I remember A.W. Pink thought that Isaac was wrong to have made this covenant with Abimelech. I see it a little bit differently. I'll go on and read to the end. And he made them a feast, and they did eat and drink, and they rose up betimes in the morning and swear one to another. And Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. And it came to pass the same day that Isaac's servants came and told him concerning the well which they had digged, and said unto him, we have found water. And he called it Sheba. Therefore the name of the city is Beersheba unto this day. I don't think that the Lord would have honored what Isaac did if he had done it with a wrong heart. The fact that the Bible makes a point of saying that it was the same day that his servants came to him and said that they had found water, which was probably at the end of a month's long operation of digging, says to me that the Lord was pleased with the heart that Isaac had. And I think about when Jesus admonished his disciples and said, if anyone compels you to go 1 mile, go two. If anyone takes away your coat, let him have your cloak also. And so when these Philistines came to him, adding insult to injury, as it were, having chased him out and stolen his wells, and said, and we've done nothing good to you, so we'd like you to make a covenant and say that you won't come after us and hold us accountable for any of the bad things we didn't do. He did it. He basically let them off the hook. And that, to me, is once again an act of trust. It's putting his trust in God and saying, you know, I'm not going to go out and try to avenge myself or secure my rights. I'm going to allow God to have his way and his say in what I have and what's best for me. So, sure, you want to be let off the hook, I'll let you off the hook. It doesn't necessarily mean they got right with God. It just means that he agreed he wasn't going to attack them, and he was even treating them with hospitality. God had not, at this time, prohibited covenants with the Canaanite peoples. Abraham made one. So I really feel like this was a good thing that Isaac did, showed his attitude that he was surrendered, the same way that he had to his father when his father put him on the altar. He was surrendering and putting his trust in God's promise. Not so his eldest son, unfortunately. And Esau was 40 years old when he took to wife Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Bashemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, which were a grief of mind unto Isaac and to Rebekah. I understand that in the Middle East, later, I don't know whether this would have been the case at the time, because of course lifespans were longer, but it was considered that a young man ought to be married by the time he was about 20. Esau was 40 And one can only imagine that by this time he was thinking, okay, I've waited long enough. I'm tired of sitting around here waiting for mom and dad to come up with somebody who's acceptable. I'm just going to marry into the local populace, get myself some good connections. This was the way in which people in this time got inheritances for themselves. They married sometimes into them. That's how they advanced, you know, political treaties were arranged through marriage, etc. Esau actually apparently inherited Mount Seir through his marriage to one of these women. I don't know which one. But he didn't get it the right way. He didn't get the promised inheritance from God. He got what he wanted for himself. It's interesting, the names of the two men into whose families he married are Be'eri, which means my well, and Elon, which means oak. So, as in, you shall be ashamed of the oaks which you have chosen. It was the oak tree was actually worshipped by the Canaanites, and so it was a kind of a symbol, their symbol of strength and stability. You know, we're connected to the land, and it's a really big tree. And I think those symbolize what Esau wanted. He wanted the things that the flesh could get for itself. He wanted to be established in a way that he could see. And the way he saw that made the most sense, and yeah, made a lot of sense. You know, marry into the Canaanites. And was exactly the wrong thing to do. From God's perspective, you grasp, you lose. And in all of this time, in all these stories, we don't see Jacob. Because he's just biding his time. Because although, as we later will discover, he went after it the wrong way, he did believe that the blessing was real. And that God was going to give the land to Abraham's seed. And he wanted whatever that was. He didn't know what it was. He had the wrong idea about what it was. But whatever it was, he wanted it. And that was the attitude that pleased God. So all along the way, it didn't happen overnight. The choices that Esau made all along the way led him to the point where he couldn't go back, couldn't change his mind, couldn't do anything about it, because he had not made those choices as his father and his grandfather, and to some extent anyway, his brother did, to put his trust in God. He that putteth his trust in me shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain.